from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum this morning, fans of acclaimed writer Lori Moore's witty and inventive short stories have waited 16 years for her latest collection, Bark. The diverse stories touch on themes ranging from divorce to 9/11, and she'll join us to discuss her work. Her previous work includes her 2009 novel, A Gate at the Stairs, and the short story collection, Birds of America. Forum is next, right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Lori Moore joins us for this Forum Hour, the author of the short story collections Birds of America and Self-Help and the novels Who Will Run the Frog Hospital and A Gate at the Stairs. She's also recipient of the Irish Times International Prize for Literature, the Penn Malamud Award, and the Reed Award for achievement in the short story. And she's now a professor of English at Vanderbilt after having been many years at the University of Wisconsin and has recently published a volume of eight stories titled Bark. She joins us for the second hour. So good to have you back here. Welcome.
Oh, well, thank you. It's great to be back.
Well, I thought to myself, I want us to talk about as many of these stories as we can, but in reading the first story, I thought to myself, I used to think, you're so daring sometimes writing in the second person like you did in Self-Help and taking big chances, but what a chance to write. It's a nice Christian girl from a home where I used to say grace all the time, writing as a Jewish male and taking that point of view. Wow. And making it totally credible. I mean, it's one thing for, say, somebody like Raymond Carver to write from a woman's point of view, but you're writing from this kind of neurotic, divorced Jewish guy.
Oh, we're all neurotic, divorced Jewish guys. Someone said to me last week, he said, you know, I really feel like I am Ira. And I said, we're all Ira.
It's like Flaubert, Madame Bovary.
Yes, and moi, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, authors enter their characters the way actors enter their characters, and you know, and men and women are not all that different from each other. They know each other very well, and Jews and Gentiles know each other very well, and it's, you know, it's not a far leap.
Well, it gave you an opportunity to be somewhat playful, I guess, about religious differences, because he goes to a dinner on Lent, is invited mm-hmm. there by his Catholic friend, who says, I wasn't cute enough to be molested by a priest. That's kind of a Lori Moore line in some ways, you know, coming out of his mouth. But
well, I've actually heard someone say that out loud. It is a dark joke.
Well, but there's also some really good jokes in this that aren't so dark. I mean, not to say that's not a good joke. Protestants say within the framework in light conversation and drive metallic-hued cars. Those kinds of observations, again, are identified with your work. But there's Ira, the Jewish guy, saying, you know, is it expected for me to essentially apologize for the crucifixion?
Well, the whole story is structured around Lent and then ends on Easter weekend. So it's following the Christian spring holidays instead of the Jewish holidays. So it further isolates him.
But you've also got the Iraq War in this story.
Well, in 2003, yeah. During that period, that's what was going on. So it was true. It's true to the events of that particular time, March 2003, and the story was published in 2003, in the New Yorker. And somebody did say to me, boy, you got to work fast. And I said, I couldn't think of anything else. You know, that was what was on everyone's mind. So.
When you do a short story, you get possessed by it. But you were possessed by politics, too, in this collection.
Well, in this, as everyone was, at least in Madison, and, you know, and I think in New York and other places as well. I mean, everyone was obsessed with what was going on at that time and very upset, I think.
It's a good example of the things my mother said never to speak about: religion, politics, and sex. It's all in the warp and woof of this first story. And also divorce and the effect that divorce has not only on those who are divorced, obviously, Ira, but also you have this pediatrician character who I was kind of fascinated with named Zora, who he meets and who he is attracted to, and they wind up dating. And she's kind of wacky, though, isn't she?
She's kind of wacky. She's not, and she, you know, she's seen through his eyes. So he's alert to all the craziness of her and also her beauty. He can't really resist her. But in the end, he does back out of that because it's just a little too nutty for him.
Well, could you tell a little bit about the details you used in the story, like Zora with the umbrella or Zora with the little statues in her?
Well, she's got a, you know, a hobby of, she's a kind of hobby sculptor, but she's also a pediatrician, and she has a teenage son who's very surly. They're very close, the mother and the son, and it kind of freaks Ira out.
Yeah, close to the point of it being pretty weird.
Yeah, it is weird. It is weird. Yeah.
It gives new meaning to Oedipal kinds of things. she had, sort of as presented to us, though, as doing these kind of phallic things with the sculptures, which I was kind of interested in, particularly in one of your later stories where you have this guy who is from another planet, from his wife's point of view, and we'll get into that maybe, making these penile things. I mean, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, but in your work...
Well, I know. I mean, in literature, you know, this is what happens. Everything is a symbol in the world of your fiction. She's making little sort of quasi fountain sculptures, and she's also using the piccolos and flutes for the phalluses. You know, those nude boys that are used, you know, as sculptures are, you know, erotic subjects.
It's interesting, too. I keep thinking about the old Kinsey study. They would say to women, are you excited by seeing a naked male? They'd hold up a statue of Ares or something, mm-hmm. you know, without the fig leaf. And that was supposed to be... it's also... We were talking the last hour about this Mozilla case with Proposition 8 and all. And the interesting thing about Ira is that he sees colors. You know, he sees pumpkin colors and he sees he can ask for directions. In other words, things that are often seen to be either effeminizing or maybe even homosexual. I mean, you nailed that because that's often true for other men who think that men who see too many nuances of colors, they must be gay, you know, or they must be effeminate in some way. Or if they ask for directions, they must be.
Well, he's alert to what the world might construe as that. You know, he's really sort of an old-fashioned guy in that way. So when he, you know, does certain things like is looking for a color of his tuxedo or is noticing the color on the blouse of the woman he's dating, you know, and then he has to sort of check himself. He keeps himself in line.
We're talking to Laurie Moore. Her new book is Bark. And in a later story, Referential, which involves a kid cutting, you say mutilation, when the character says mutilation was a language or vice versa. And it kind of, in this first story, you know, kids saying whatever, for example, or the word bummer, which I think has been kind of almost out of vogue to a great extent. But all the subtext that those words embody. I mean, you're getting at something I think that's really quite interesting from a linguistic standpoint.
You mean the evasion?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's a lot of whateverness in the world now.
I just read John McWhorter in the New York Times. He said the word like has been, you know, overly criticized, but it's actually a whole form of punctuation and of expression and that sort of thing. In other words, he was defending it.
Right. It's a little bit, I suppose it's like allure in French. You know, they say allure. You know, it's a stalling tactic.
I never knew about her bed that is herbed as a way of supposedly consummating or bringing to attention the likelihood of consummation?
I don't know. That's just something his friend says when he's at a loss. You know, he's taking all advice because he's quite unmoored, you know, being divorced. So He takes everybody's advice.
You get into the pain of divorce, but you also do your usual kind of wordplay, especially from him. You know, we've mentioned, I said wacky before, wacky, Waco, these kinds of things. A lot of punning in his head.
But people do that all the time. People really do, if you pay attention. Yeah, they do. And it also suggests the instability of language and also the instability of his emotional state, I suppose, vis-a-vis language.
You're trying to show also, it seems to me, in a number of these stories, how language breaks down and again, the pain and really desperation of divorce.
Yeah. I mean, at one point, I think I have the character say, the pain of divorce is a national secret. I can't remember which character says that now. But it is one of those things that I think is true. I mean, it's a very common condition and a common event. But every divorce is different, which Tolstoy didn't quite say, but he would say if he were alive.
He might have said every family is alligators, which is what you say.
Well, one of the characters says that. I don't say that.
You as ventriloquist, forgive me, as one of the characters.
Well, I don't take responsibility for what my characters say. I'll take responsibility for it, but I don't necessarily, you know, feel that they're expressing my opinion. It's sort of like the radio station and then the people on the radio. There's a disclaimer there.
Thank you for that analogy. Talking again with Laurie Moore. What about, in fact, talking about language, the word bark? I mean, you've got three epigraphs, no less. And, you know, one goes throughout these stories realizing that you're talking about, Ira talks about his wife barking at him. In fact, the story's called De Bark. Another story, we talk about the bark of the brain, bark of tree, and there's a lot of symbolism here. You mentioned symbolism before. I mean, Ira can't even get off his wedding ring, but let's talk about bark and your thoughts about it.
Well, it's one of those great Anglo-Saxon words, and I noticed it showing up in all of my stories. It's probably been in every single other story that I've ever written. You know, it's probably been in the other collections as well.
There will be dissertations on this.
Well, I'm sure there won't be, but... so I did notice that, and I thought, well, isn't that interesting how it's both the surface and protection on a tree? It's also the very thing that makes, I mean, it's close to what makes paper, what you write on. It's a vessel to cross a river. A bark is the same as a barge or boat, a small boat. You know, there's a famous painting, The Bark of Dante, where the river Styx is being crossed. And at any rate, and also it's a yelp, first and foremost. It's a kind of animal cry. And that's the primary meaning that was with me when I titled it, so...
And the bark is not necessarily worse than a bite. One of your characters reverts that and says, of course a bite is worse than a bark.
Well, of course a bite is worse, yes.
Talking again with Laurie Moore, there's a story that involves these two characters who are going through a real hell in terms of marriage. Actually, it's a woman who's going through her name is Kit and her husband's name is Rafe, and he hasn't even kissed her in a year, and... She sort of makes gradations about unhappiness. What is the best unhappiness to live with? I mean, it's a sad story in many ways, and yet they decide to go on this trip with their children just to keep things together, the Caribbean. And what's striking about this is she keeps seeing him as somebody either who has some kind of serious brain injury or a brain tumor or is from another planet. It's like, where's the hippie guy I married? You know, what happened to him? He's gone through a complete transformation. And it turns out, of course, he's got someone else. But
right. Well, that's what it can look like to many people. I've heard others say this, that when someone is having a secret life and you haven't successfully imagined it, you imagine it as being something else, like, oh my goodness, something... is wrong, and maybe it's a brain tumor, or maybe he's been possessed by demons or something. When the most obvious thing is staring at you, and you just aren't acknowledging it.
I was also struck in this story, also has a wedding ring of importance in it, so
yes,
things do keep coming back in
your
story.
There's two wedding rings that won't come off.
But I'm also struck, and also a masseur named Daniel Handler, that, you know, he's a local author.
Yes, I know. Yeah. He bought and paid his way into that story.
Oh, he did.
It was part of the First Amendment Project, and he auctioned. He won the auction to be in my next story, which turned out to be Paper Losses, and I had a massage therapist, and I said, I'm going to name him Daniel Handler. What could be a better name for a masseur?
That must have been a hoot for Daniel Handler.
he didn't mind.
I'm not going to give a spoiler alert even here. I'm not even going to say the way the story ends, except to say what I was struck by was it ends in a way, I mean, it does end in the marriage, as I've kind of intimated already, failing, but also ends with a story in her mind substituting for the story that takes place, which is often what people do, you know. I mean, especially when they're in conversation about their lives and things going awry in their lives.
Yeah. Right. And strangely, it lands on not a repudiation of marriage, but an affirmation.
Yes, exactly.
And that's what she's left with, this kind of affirmation of marriage, and a kind of sad note that her own children will grow up and perhaps never even remember their parents being married.
There's also a story in the collection, Thank You for Having Me, which involves a nanny, a Brazilian nanny, who has gone through one divorce. Her ex-husband is there at the wedding playing music, as well as his father admiring and kind of maybe drooling over his former daughter-in-law. And it's a story about divorce as well. But suddenly a motorcycle gang appears. And I thought to myself, where the hell did they come from? I mean, it reminded me, you know, I teach Flannery O'Connor, and she writes this wonderful essay about the wooden leg in the story Good Country People, and she wasn't sure that the guy was going to take the wooden leg and run away. Was that like that?
Yeah. It was a little bit like that. I mean, if you were at a country wedding in Wisconsin, and this is all set in Wisconsin, the story is a little bit my farewell to Wisconsin, but if you're at a country wedding in June, a motorcycle gang will go by. And so I knew that because people are just on their motorcycles. They're so happy that winter's over. They're driving around all these little roads. And I suddenly, instead of having them drive by, I had them turn in to the driveway and actually stop and make an appearance and a little speech.
So, well, yeah, they thought it was another wedding, it turns out.
Right.
It could have been pretty volatile. I mean, you give that tension of what are these people doing here? What's going on? There's also, you know, the difficulty of raising teenagers in this story and in a number of the stories.
Teenagers are such interesting creatures and often bewildering creatures to their parents, because the parents always feel they understand who their children are up to a certain age, and then of course children get older and get separated and go out into the world, and they become tall, they become, you know, independent, they become surly, they become all kinds of things that the parents are suddenly a little bit frightened of.
You have a teenage son, and I don't want to get in fiction and reality and all that. I mean, a lot of people wonder, though, about the story you wrote about a oncology clinic for children, if that was a personal experience, because it was such a vivid, emotional story. Almost an infant, really, with a cancer.
Well, many of my stories are prompted by real-life things, but then once I start writing them, they go their own way. And that story is not a piece of autobiography, but it is prompted by something in my life.
And you also mentioned your farewell to Madison. We should mention, I said in the beginning, you're now a professor at Vanderbilt, but you were many years at University of Wisconsin, long after I had left. And I had a real relationship in your work in terms of setting and place and even the culture of Madison that I, as a reader, certainly experienced. And I said before we went on there, it's probably going to be different now, but you don't think so. Not necessarily.
I don't know. I have no idea. You know, I just moved to Nashville. I still have my house in Madison. I have bought a condo in Nashville, but I haven't had the opportunity to move in because I'm on this book tour. So I'm still living. I'm living in this little rental behind a Dunkin' Donuts. So I don't. And I'm teaching at Vanderbilt. I don't know what will happen. We'll see.
Well, I guess part of what prompts that question is, you know, this platitude you hear about. Well, people are people anywhere you go, and maybe there's some truth to that. I don't know.
Well, Nashville is a different culture, and the South is different. But all, you know, just as the Midwest has changed a lot. The South has changed a lot. Nashville's also full of Midwesterners. Mm-hmm. I feel sometimes that half the people from Chicago went up to Madison, the other half went to Nashville. I feel like I've met all these Chicagoans.
We're talking again with Lori Moore, and her new book is called Bark, and we're going to invite your involvement in this program. I mentioned Iraq, but there's a lot of touching on politics, even in the story about Kit and Rafe. They were anti-nuke, and now there's pro-nuke. And I mean, it's a kind of, I know it's not in your foreground in your stories, but it's certainly in the background of most of these stories.
Well, it's in people's lives, and it would be dishonest to not include it if it isn't these people's lives. If you're, you know, a thinking person and going through the day and thinking about the world you're in and the life you're living, these things are going to, you know, be in your thoughts.
Well, there's certainly a lot of richness in these stories and a lot of thoughts and a lot of emotions. Only 8 stories, though, and it's the first time in over a decade. And that's what you're hearing, isn't it?
I don't know. I don't know why people say this. This is my second longest collection. My first 2 collections were shorter than this. But somehow this book is taking the rap for being short.
I guess because it's 8 stories, but some of the stories are long stories and very effective stories, I might add.
My first collection had 9 stories, and I think my second collection had 8 or 9.
Is it as tough to write a story as a novel? Some say yes. You say what?
Oh, writing a novel is the hardest thing you can do, I think. Mm-hmm. It's very hard, and it takes a long time, but it's wonderfully fulfilling and exciting, and it takes years, and you can really fail at it. Whereas a short story, you can succeed a little more easily on its own terms. The longer a story gets, the more you will feel its failures. So, for instance, the longest story in this book is the one I had the most hopes for and the one I feel more disappointed in because I wanted it to be so great. I mean, the longer things go on, the more opportunity for...
That's Juniper Tree?
No, that it's a story called Wings.
Oh, the Wings story, yeah.
It's the longest story in there.
It is the longest, now that I think about it. It's also kind of a fascinating triangle, really.
It's a Henry James triangle, yeah.
In fact, I mentioned Juniper Tree, which is kind of, well, it's a ghost story. I wouldn't necessarily call it a Henry James story, but Wings of the Dove came to mind.
Well, Wings of the Dove is definitely in the story Wings. I made a lot of effort to signal to that, but it does is lift a very basic plot element that other people have used as well, and Henry James used it over and over again, twisted it around in different novels. Terrence Malick used it in Days of Heaven, his film Days of Heaven. It's just about two people plotting against a third person for money. I mean, that's an age old idea, but it's elemental. It's incredibly interesting, and it is also part and parcel of a gilded age that I think we're also in, the way Henry James was in it.
We're going to talk some more with Lori Moore, but we're also going to welcome you. Join us. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. We're talking with acclaimed author Lori Moore this hour, and her previous work includes her 2009 A Gate at the Stairs, which we discussed with her, and short story collection Birds of America, and a new short story collection is out. Waited 16 years for this. It's called Bark, and a diverse range of stories touching on themes ranging from divorce to 9/11, and we're discussing her work, and you are welcome to discuss her work with us or with her. Our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org. And there are, of course, other ways to Let us know your thoughts or any questions or comments you might have. You can go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. And you can also go to our Facebook page. I'm talking about Henry James. The name came up, kind of crossed over in another synapse in my cerebellum or whatever. And he is the master still, really, isn't he? I mean, when it comes to short stories, I mean, we admire figures. I know you do, like I do, Alice Munro, Raymond Carver, we can name, and certainly Chekhov, maybe even above the whole rest of them. But in terms of American short story writers, does James have any equal, really?
I would put I think Alice Munro has a lot in common with James, actually.
Well, she's Canadian. No, I'm
joking. But we could say North American. Yeah, I think we can confidently say that North America now owns the short story form, or genre, we should call it. I think in the 19th century, it was probably more the Russian short story, and perhaps the French. And the Irish have always done very well in that genre. The English less well.
They're say America owns it mainly because of, Munro also, like you, published a lot in The New Yorker, so we'll consider her, she's an American lit anthologies and so forth, but because of her and Raymond Carver and who else?
Oh, the contemporary short story writers right now, from George Saunders to Tobias Wolff to Richard Ford, I mean, some of these people are really just doing their very best work in that short narrative genre. And it's no longer a commercial genre. It's a true art form.
But there's still this tendency. In fact, it came up, I believe, when Ethan Kanan was last on, to have publishers say, well, we want a novel out of you. A novel is going to, not necessarily in your case, because you've had a pretty devoted following, but for a lot of writers, I think.
I guess that may be changing. I don't know. I feel I'm one of the few writers who has, from the beginning, been discouraged from writing novels. But I think right now, when you take a look at Karen Russell, Jhumpa Lahiri, George Saunders, their collections actually have a commercial life. I mean, it's not a commercial form, and they're writing so beautifully within that form, but people are there to buy it. As much as there is a reading public, a serious reading public will buy collections of stories, I do think. Not to a huge extent, but the Saunders collection was very successful.
I love the Saunders collection.
Yeah,
I think
he's great.
I think he's a great short story writer, and I agree with you, of course, about Munro and about Jhumpa Lahiri. In fact, I think better at the short story than the novel in her case. I'll just go on record with that opinion. Fairly well-formed opinion. And you've got
Edward Jones is a fantastic short story writer.
We featured him on this program. I agree with you.
He's
and Jenny Egan, you know. Really thought the Goon Squad was really an enjoyable.
I mean, that was a novel in stories, and that's another kind of form we're seeing, novels told in stories. I mean, that it's always been done. I mean, Winesburg, Ohio was that.
And Kane.
Yeah.
There's a lot of talent out there. I quite agree with
Lots.
You. But it's difficult. I mean, the marketing of short stories, the selling of short stories has become increasingly difficult. And also the internet has made for a different kind of, people just post their stories now. And you've got narrative here in out of San Francisco. And,
right.
Well, let me bring our callers into this. You may want to talk about, short story writers, for example, that you particularly are drawn to. You may want to bring into the conversation, or just an opportunity for you to talk with one of our leading fiction writers, Laurie Moore. Go first to Alicia. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for this program. I wanted to say that I was not familiar with Ms. Moore's work, but I heard her interviewed on another station, and I ran right out and got her book. And what I wanted to ask about was your use of humor in your stories. The first story, Debarking, I almost wet my pants reading. It was so funny. But I noticed that as the stories went on, they became, to me, less and less, you know, that wildly, hysterically funny. And I just wondered, do you like purposely use humor in a way, and for what purpose? And do you plan to write more hysterically funny stories?
Oh, well, thank you very much. I just find the world and people incredibly funny. I don't find life very funny. I think life itself is sort of, you know, it's got a lot of design flaws in it, and so it offers potential for some sad stories to be written about it. But within that, people maintain their humor, their resilience, and humor is just all part of it, and I wouldn't want to exclude it. Obviously, some stories will have more humor in them than others, but I don't necessarily even like to think that I'm using humor as much as discovering it and letting it walk in to the story.
But you are often labeled a funny writer, and you are clever, and you do things that are comedic in many of your stories. But do you resist being labeled as a writer of humor, or is there part of you that thinks of that as not necessarily a tag you'd like?
I mean, I think most writers don't like any tag, but I'm fine with however, you know, whatever experience you're having of the story is fine with me. And I also have great respect for humor writers. I mean, I could never do that. I mean, people who write humor pieces.
Or Saunders is a very funny writer.
Saunders is a very funny writer. You know, and actually Alice Munro is very funny.
She can be, yeah.
She can be very funny. She doesn't get a lot of credit for that, but she, or discredit sometimes. You end up getting discredit for being funny.
Does that take away from the seriousness of the work for some writers, you think? Being labeled that way or tagged that way? Yeah.
I should hope not, but it's part of the spectrum of it's part of the spectrum of the human mind and the human experience. So,
talking to Laurie Moore, we'll go to more of your calls. Welcome, Tamara. Good morning.
Good morning. Laurie, I am so happy to be able to hear you on Michael's program and to be able to speak with you. Thanks.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, the New York Times a book reviewer, I loved what that person said, that you gave meaning to the you gave new meaning to the use of the exclamation point. And when I read that, it reminded me of a short story in Birds of America. So I pulled out my dog-eared copy and reread the story that you used the word ha with an exclamation point in capital letters for over two pages. And I wanted to know a couple of things. First of all, did your editor try to talk you out of doing that? Because I feel like it's so effective. And also, what prompted you at that point in that story to use that technique?
Well, I was writing the story, and the character at that point is, we're in her perspective, and we're thinking over what she is thinking about her husband's various affairs. And so it's a kind of hysteria in her, and but she's trying to dismiss it. And what comes out is a kind of scream. And I started to type, you know, ha, what she thought of it was ha, 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 ha. And then I just kept going, ha, ha, ha. And then I was filling up an entire page. And then I filled up another page, and I thought, you know, that might be enough, because if I really kept going, I would really have to add 73 more pages or something to really have a different effect. But I just found myself doing it to register the scream of both denial and observation and heartbreak that this character was experiencing. Now, when the story went into The New Yorker pays by the word, and they were not going to pay for all those ha-has. So in the New Yorker, it had to be shrunk down to about a paragraph. But they said to me, well, you can have it the way it, you know, you can have it in the original form in the book. And that's the way we did it. My editor was totally fine with it.
And thank you for the call.
Yeah, thank you for the question.
Actually, I remember that New York Times piece about you. There was one point where you said you were dating a visual artist. Still dating a visual artist? Or?
Oh, no, I'm not. No.
Well, it wasn't print, so naturally.
Yeah, no, I was very fond of him. He actually died 2 weeks ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. But, you know, his art was very beautiful and will live on.
It makes me think about the way you portray dating in this era in Bark. I mean, again, in the opening story, he's kind of struck by this woman, this pediatrician, Zora, and he doesn't quite know how to approach it and decides that he'll send a note to her, but it's somewhere between, I think the phrasing is in his mind, stalking and Rip Van Winkle. kind of humorous note right there. People who get divorced and are out in that world again, especially as it's changed so radically under the cyber changes, it's difficult. I mean, it's a different world, different planet again.
I think it is for a lot of divorced people, and I have to say I am divorced, and after I was divorced, you know, a long time ago already. It was like 13 years ago, I think, 2001. But for about 6 months after my divorce, I only wanted to hang out with other people who were divorced. And there are a lot of other people who are divorced, so it wasn't really, it didn't put a crimp in my social life. So I just wanted to hear everyone else's stories about divorce, which I hadn't really been that interested in hearing before, because I assumed in this kind of Tolstoyan way that all divorces are the same, all happy marriages are the same. Well, in fact, every divorce is extremely different, and they all have very interesting angles and details, some of which are quite unbelievable. And so the world of divorce became quite interesting to me. It's full of heartbreak and sometimes full of really craziness and violence. But I mean, when you read about horrible things happening between estranged couples, you know, they're going through a divorce. I mean, and sometimes there's guns and all of that. Now, 70% of marriages end in divorce now.
Is that high?
It's that high.
I thought it was around 50%, but we'll have to check our figures.
Well,
on
even
that.
If it were 50, that's a, you know, that's a big statistic.
Although it's been going slightly down, I think. And we're going to go to some more callers here. By the way, Laurie Moore will be at Mrs. Dalloway's in Berkeley tonight at 7:30, if you'd like to meet the author. And you'll be talking about Bark there and maybe even reading from it?
I guess, or maybe talk more about death and violence. I feel like I've introduced all these horrible topics.
Well, but we talked about your humor. We did... These are darker stories, though. I mean, it's not to say that your other stories weren't dark, but I think something happening to you as, you've gone through, I don't like necessarily the genetic view of literature, you know, to see things in terms of one's life and the transformations. But you mentioned a divorce 13 years ago. It's been 12 years since your last collection and, you know, also raising a teenager and going through the Sturm und Drang of life, now a big change to another university. Changes.
Well, supposedly change is good for writing. We'll see.
Let me bring another caller on, and that's you, CJ. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes, sir. You're on the
Hi.
Air.
Yeah. I'm a fan of Laurie Wood's fiction, and I've been reading it for a long time. I was struck by the closing lines of your story, Wings. Given a new purpose by God, whose persistent mad humor was aimless as a gnat, she was waiting for him to come back with something they could use. Okay, and I was struck by the similarity of this to the fundamental assumptions of Hindu philosophy, which, you know, begins with Rig Veda's hymn of creation. There's just five short lines I'd like to quote from the Rig Veda. Whence this creation has arisen, perhaps it formed itself, or perhaps not. The one who looks down on it in the highest heaven, only he knows, or perhaps he knows not. And then basic assumptions of Hindu philosophy is that the creator felt lonely and created and made this creation so that he could play hide and seek and not feel so lonely. My question is, did you have any of this in mind while you were writing these lines?
I think I had a certain idea that there was an element of cruelty to the creation and perhaps to the creator, and a certain element of play and elusiveness. But I really don't. I mean, these are ideas that exist, you know, outside of religion and also inside religion. I don't really know Hindu philosophy very well at all, so I wasn't thinking specifically of that. But it did. These lines did come out of the character's state of mind. So mostly I was thinking about what she would feel at that particular moment.
Let me thank CJ for the call. There is a lot of philosophy and philosophizing by many of your characters. I mean, they get those sorts of thoughts streaming through their minds, and you make us see through a portal to what they are experiencing and thinking about. You mentioned before design having a lot of flaws in it, and maybe prompt you to talk a little bit more about that philosophically, apart from your characters or through your characters. There's a sonnet by Robert Frost called Design, where he says, in effect, what's the designer if evil takes place? I mean, I'm obviously right. But beyond that, he says, maybe things would just happen randomly, you know. Mm-hmm. They can just happen without any design at all, except the design of things right. that are appalling, right?
Right. I sort of think all things are true. There's a bit of design and a lot of randomness, and randomness can be a design, and design can be randomness, you know. But there's just a lot of suffering in life, you know. It is a veil of tears, and the ways in which we're resilient and find ways to amuse each other and take care of each other are interesting to me, as are the ways in which we fail to do those things. So, and that's what I think literature is addressing. Stories are interested in the psychological makeup of characters, but they're also interested in the spiritual makeup of them as well.
Talking again with Laurie Moore. Her new book is Bark, and she will be at Mrs. Dalloway's in Berkeley tonight at 7:30. You can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Here's an email from Scott, who writes, it was said that the short story is no longer a commercial medium, but what about the magazine being so predominant as a forum for contemporary writers? It seems like so many writers are publishing collections that are made up entirely of material published in The New Yorker or similar magazines. Does this reflect the state of the publishing world and the shrinking attention span of U.S. readers?
I never think that the short story is for shrinking attention spans. I think you have to sit for 45 minutes straight to read a short story, and you can dip in and out of a novel. I mean, I don't buy that particular idea. When I say it's no longer a commercial form, I mean that you cannot support your family by writing short stories, which Fitzgerald did. Hemingway did to some extent, although he was also working as a journalist.
A lot of writers did. I mean,
John Updike did.
Yeah, Styron, I think, certainly did a lot of supporting of his family through stories. Irwin Shaw did too.
But those days are gone. Yeah. Although, as I said, the collection itself can have, you know, a better publishing life than publishers have historically given it.
Well, there is that difference. I mean, kind of the manifesto of this was written by Poe when he said, you know, you read a short story and you read it and then you're done with it, as opposed to the novel that you say you can pick up over and over again. But I find that as the older generation moves into the millennials and the younger generation, they text a lot, they email a lot. Don't necessarily have the patience for novels that we used to have, or that putting us together here, but, you know, those of us who are not X, Y, or Z generation, you may be on that, but I'm not, or millennials. And the truth of the matter is, I just saw Robert Coover's new novel, for example. It's, I admire Robert Coover a lot, but it's like a monster. He calls it the monster. It's taken many years. It's hundreds and hundreds of pages. And I wonder how many people are game to read that.
Well, I don't know. You know, Donna Tartt's novel is 800 pages. It's a best-selling book, and I don't know.
The Goldfinch, yeah.
The Goldfinch and Harry Potter. I mean, you know, people can read Harry Potter. So it's not the length. It may be that to enter that kind of long narrative, they want to be in some kind of artificial fantasy world. If they're going to embark on it, they don't want to be in someone's intellectual exercise. I don't know. I don't want to speculate.
Well, they want to be engaged. They want to have their suspense involved and all those kinds of things that make for good storytelling. You know?
I guess they want. I mean, I think we're going to see what happens to literature as the one or two generations that grew up on Harry Potter, I mean, read them, reread them, over and over again. Those are big books. What happens to them as they become adults, as they become middle-aged? I mean, they're already adults, many of them. And as they become middle-aged, as they become older, I mean, how is the publishing world going to respond to them, and what is going to be published as a result? I think a lot of fantasy.
Looking at our website, Mary writes, what about short story writer Paula Fox? I mean, we've mentioned a lot of short story writers.
She's wonderful.
Yeah, thanks for bringing her back to our attention here, Mary. Glenn asks, this is kind of a wide-open question, what did you learn about writing while working on these new stories?
What did I learn about writing? Oh, I'm not in the business of learning about writing, I guess. I'm just trying to sort of tell the story the best I can. I think One of the things that writers are thought to be is good with words. And I think what you learn when you write, every time you sit down to write, is how not good with words you are. You're starting with a feeling, a sense of story, but the language is really hard to find. And to that extent, one is reacquainted every time one writes with one's inadequacies vis-a-vis language. And so you have to work very hard with English, which is a beautiful language, full and rich and sprawling, and can go high and low and all different directions. But it may sometimes still seem like a second language when you're beginning with feelings and ideas and people, which is what you begin with.
Thinking again of something you once said, talking about English can feel like a second language. I think it was Nabokov's, fifth language maybe? And yet he was so in love and enraptured with, as you can see in Lolita and Panin. But something I was struck by was you're remarking about Vera Nabokov, who often doesn't get the spotlight, to put it mildly, compared to her husband, who would go in and lecture for him without notes at Cornell, whereas Nabokov needed notes to rely on.
Yes, well, go figure.
But you also said everybody needs a Vera, you know. It's like everybody needs that kind of a wife.
Well, you know, it would be great if everyone did have that. I mean, she was very self-sacrificing. Her English was actually better than her husband's, so she cleaned up his English a little bit. She typed up his manuscripts, and she drove the car on their butterfly trips. You know, he didn't have a driver's license. I don't think he could even make a phone call. I mean, she really did everything for him. There are women writers who have had husbands who take care of them. Edna St. Vincent Millay famously did. Virginia Woolf, to some extent. You know, it was interesting to me that somewhere along the line in this past year's publicity on Alice Munro, that she talked about how her husband, Jerry, would sometimes help her type up the manuscripts. And, you know, they would have a deadline and they would be madly typing together. And I thought, that's interesting. Who'd have thunk it? And So, but most women generally, and also Alice Munro, I don't think drives. So I think her husband did the driving. So she had a little, she had a little help there, and she had tremendous productivity through those years of being married to him. So
a number of artists come to mind, both men and women, who have mates who do a lot of the. It's a curious division of labor. I mean, they're there in large part often to support and to be an ally, but also to do things that are just, most people think, quotidian things.
Right. And if you see it as if the family business, you see it as a kind of cottage industry and you work together, it can be more helpful.
Cecile, let's get you on with little time left, please.
Okay. Just wanted to say thank you so much for your work, Ms. Moore, and I'm so glad you talked about language, because it feels like we live in such a literal society, and the talk of the literature becomes so literal. And I think that I read for language, and if I can't find language in a novel or a short story, I'm not interested in it. So we all have wonderful stories to tell each other, but it's the artist who has the language to write. And somehow talk of both personal income, which is not to be dismissed, and of literalizing a subject matter like philosophy, of course, is going to be in a good piece of literature. So thank you very much.
And thank you, Cecile. It's interesting to hear you called Miss Moore, isn't it?
In Nashville, that's what they sometimes call me, Miss Laurie in Nashville. I like that.
There's a Miss Moore in a story by Tony Cade Bambara called The Lesson, and there's Mrs. Moore in Passage to India. Yeah.
Right.
So good to have you back on Forum.
Oh,
thank you for being with
us. Thank you. It's great to be here.
The book is Bark. New Laurie Moore book should be at Mrs. Dalloway's tonight in Berkeley at 7:30. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and also our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Vinnie Tong. And our engineer is Danny Bringer. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.